Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Go and check out the website at scotthorton.org. It's no longer brown. It was once made brown, but now is no longer brown. So go check that out, scotthorton.org. More than 2,700 interviews going back to 2003. At scotthorton.org. All right, our next guest is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer, and he's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org, and he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and for antiwar.com. And the latest at antiwar.com is really great. I hope you guys will take the time this weekend to look at it or something if you can. It's called Talking Turkey About Zionism. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How's it going?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us.
No problem.
Okay, so this guy, I don't know how to pronounce all his names, but his last name is Erdogan. He's the prime minister of Turkey, and he got himself in trouble for some things that he said, which isn't new in Washington, D.C. Fill us in.
Yeah, well, Erdogan, at a U.N. conference in Vienna, was basically speaking on the issue of Islamophobia and was saying that Islamophobia should be something that people will fight against, just like they should fight against other oppressive ideologies and ways of thinking. And he identified fascism, anti-Semitism, and Zionism. And, of course, fascism and anti-Semitism were okay, but when he mentioned Zionism, that produced an instant reaction from neoconservatives and others in the United States.
You know, I guess it's really just the same as anything. Nobody ever wants to talk about the actual argument and whether there's anything to it or not. Everything is supposedly, listening to the public debate, it's always just supposedly self-evidently crazy or hateful or wrong or whatever, but I mean, geez, isn't there kind of a point there that Zionism sort of means, and if you're in the way, screw you, right?
Well, yeah, that's the point. I mean, and the point of my article was basically that the people who attacked Erdogan basically started attacking Turkey and attacking Turkey's record and what Turkey represents and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I tried to make the point that really, all right.
Instead of the argument, you mean? They went ahead and started attacking Turkey instead of the argument he was making.
Exactly what they did. Yeah. And I said, so, all right, basically, if you look at the Zionism, not as a philosophy or a political theory, but as what it is in practice, you can't get away from the fact that Zionism has meant the dispossession of millions of Palestinians. And this is an ongoing process. It's not something that happened back in 1947 and stopped. And, so anyway, Erdogan had a point and probably a pretty good point. And the guys who were attacking him basically were attacking him ad hominem and were making up arguments about why Turkey is such a bad place and so on and so forth. So it was, yeah, exactly that kind of argument. Let's say, all right, fine, you don't like Erdogan, but at the same time is what he's saying makes sense, and I think it does.
All right, now Turkey has been an ally of the United States and NATO since the end of World War II and the establishment of the alliance, and Turkey's been, I always thought, long time bosom buddies with the Israelis. And I mean government to government, bureaucrat to bureaucrat, intel officers and military men. These guys are friends. They share money and equipment and an American sponsor. And so what happened?
Well, there's a debate going on to what extent this break between the two countries is for real. There's a lot of evidence that the Turkish military and Turkish businessmen in general have excellent relationships with their Israeli counterparts. The point is Erdogan is you know, head of state, and to a certain extent, he has to take a different position. And the different position is essentially that since the Israelis killed those nine Turks, 2 years ago when they were trying to bring in relief supplies to Gaza. Israel is kind of an unpopular country in terms of the Turkish viewpoint, and so Erdogan is in a position where he has to reflect that in terms of what he's saying and what he's doing, while to a certain extent business as usual is continuing on other levels.
Mm-hmm. And now, did I characterize that business as usual correctly, you think, there, as far as military and intelligence agencies and you know, the not even the deep state, but just, you know, the shallow end, the just the governments, really?
Well, there's probably a lot of deep state stuff going on, too, because both Israel and Turkey have deep states.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I just assumed that, but I mean, but what about just the almost surface stuff?
Yeah, well, the almost surface stuff is going on too. I mean, they've had, they've actually had some military exercises, I believe, that were not very widely publicized for obvious reasons. And, there's been cooperation at various levels. Yeah, I think there's clear evidence that that's taking place.
Yeah, so all these guys who decide they want to take out after Erdogan, they ought to be, you know, even if they want to be critical of him, they could just give him the left-handed compliment that, yeah, well, you do what Israel likes anyway, so.
Yeah, well, you know, to a certain extent, that's true. But the point is, Erdogan was making a good point, and was jumped on because of it. And then the ones who were the critics that I cited in the article, basically, you know, they were attacking Turkey for the fact that, according to one of them, religious freedom is substandard in Turkey, and that one of them called, Turkey an Islamist regime, which is not even close to the truth. I mean, Turkey has an extremely volatile political situation, and there are lots of people that basically are not supporters of any kind of Islamic agenda. And these are the people, to a certain extent, that count in the country. These are the military officers, the journalists, the academics, people who are key businessmen and all that sort of thing. There's not a simple way of describing the politics in Turkey any more than there's a simple way of describing it in the United States.
Right, and you know, actually, that was, I kind of appreciate the fact that these guys made all these red herring arguments, if only for provoking you into writing this article, because it's well, I sure learned a hell of a lot about Turkey in just hearing you refute these different points. And I think that one is, you know, first and foremost an important thing, because it's pretty easy, since, you know, 99% of us have never been to Turkey or even know anybody who has been or anything like that. It's pretty easy to paint Turkey however you want, especially like in right-wing media. You could make it Osama bin Laden's Islamo-fascist caliphate if you want to, and they'll believe it at least for a weekend or however long you need them to. And so it really is important, right, that history of the secularism in Turkey and how, like you say, there's a long history of it there, and therefore there are a lot of entrenched interests. It's not like, you know, Mubarak and his few cronies. There are huge entrenched interests who are still kind of secular Turks, and even with the election of the Islamists, it's really, they're not the kind of Islamists that you read about in National Review, even if you're reading about these guys, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, everybody who has observed Turkey in any serious way agrees that this Islamism that the dominant party there, the AKP, demonstrates is pretty mild stuff. I mean, there was, as early last year, there was a major controversy over allowing women to wear headscarves at universities and everything like that. And the fact is, they're not allowed to wear headscarves at universities. And it's only now at Islamic schools in Turkey that women can wear headscarves. So the secular people in Turkey are pretty powerful, and they're doing a lot of pushback. And so it's not a simple kind of equation. Turks are Muslims. You know, the country is 98% Muslim. And the fact is you can't get away from that. And what essentially the current Turkish government has done is it's kind of brought Islam out of the closet, because under Ataturk, Islam had no role in government, no role anywhere near what we would consider government and institutions. And now Erdogan is saying, look, I mean, we're all Muslims, and let's try to legitimize what many people actually feel. And that's essentially what's going on. This is not suddenly the crazies are out of the box, although like in any other change, there will be crazies coming out of the box, but it's not what it's all about.
Mm. Well, and so you also talk in the article about the treatment of the different minority groups, ethnic and religious-wise, in the country, and things must be far from perfect on that front. Certainly, well, I don't know all that much about it, but I remember reading back in the 1990s about how Bill Clinton was shipping the Turks a bunch of weapons to use against the Kurds.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at it this way. I mean, back in 1918, the Turks, or the Ottoman Empire, was a defeated power. It was occupied by the British and the French. And then a year or so later, the Greeks invaded. And that's when the Turkish war of reconquest and everything took place. And this was Ataturk. And Ataturk's principal objective was to restore Turkey and to give it an identity. This was a shattered people that really had no identity, had no purpose. And so he basically brought in a lot of laws that made the country Turkish. You know, it required people to speak only one language. I mean, you've heard the same kind of stuff in the U.S. Speak one language, you know, study one curriculum, keep religion out of politics. You know, this is what Ataturk pushed. And this is Kemalism, which is what it's called, has been a dominant force in Turkey ever since. So when you get a group like the Kurds saying, hey, we want to speak our own language, we want to have our own culture, that hits to the core, to the heart of what Kemalism is all about and what the Turkish revival in the 1920s and thereafter constituted.
Well, and so, but how brutal does it get, though, on a regular basis, for example?
Oh, yeah, it gets brutal. It gets nasty. There's no question about it. I'm not, and I didn't attempt to exonerate any of that in my piece. I just said, basically, look, this is why they see things the way they see them. And, you know, this is ultimately the problem with most Americans. We tend to see things through a kind of, glasses that show us what we want to see, and we don't understand that in other parts of the world, people see things quite differently.
Mm. Well, now, I think it was Eric Margolies who really characterized the rise of Erdogan and kind of a little bit of a pushing to the side of the old secularism as really that's the real dawn of the Arab Spring or the Muslim Spring or the democratic revolution in the region, was that it really is, you know, Saddam or not or whatever, it's becoming way too difficult to keep a dictatorship in the region. People are just too educated with their satellite TVs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. I think actually it's more so that Turkey has become the model for many of the Arab states in terms of where they would like to wind up with essentially a pluralistic system that has popular representation and that also is Muslim in at its heart. And I think that essentially Turkey is a good model for that. I mean, it's easy to not Turkish democracy, but they have elections, they have political parties, they have an active press, they have a lot of the things that we look for as being part and parcel of a democratic system.
All right, now, if it's okay, I want to switch to an Iran question for you. There's a story going around, I guess it's big news today, that he's been indicted in court in New York. Grand jury in New York has indicted a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden for material support for terrorism. And I heard it reported on NPR, and they sort of let it hang for a second. That, well, he's been in Iran, but without much more detail than that. And So I just wonder if you know the story of this guy, and do you know anything about the circumstances of his time spent in Iran or any kind of context that might matter there?
Well, he was one of the bin Laden family that was arrested by the Iranians when they were fleeing Afghanistan at the beginning of 2002. And in fact, there have been reports, which I think are credible, that the Iranians actually offered to turn him and the other al-Qaeda and family members that they captured at the time over to the U.S., but the George Bush refused. He was going to do it himself, I guess. But anyway, so he's been a spokesman for al-Qaeda, so there's no question that under the applicable laws of war as perceived by the U.S. government, he's fair game. He is al-Qaeda, there's no question about it. He's been active, played an active role with al-Qaeda, and I'm not even sure why they had to resort to material assistance, because he's certainly done more than that. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because the way it's going, he might actually get tried. Now that would be really interesting to watch, to see what kind of defense he offers and to see what's said in court.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why they didn't just drone him to death or just shoot him, right? How many CIA agents are stationed in Jordan right now? Why didn't they just kill him?
I don't know. I mean, it was, but then again, that suggests that the White House is willing to try him, which is interesting. Because this had to be a top level decision. They could have killed him, I'm sure, or could have had the Jordanians kill him. And so that is an interesting point. It rather suggests we're going to actually see a terrorism trial, which would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it sure would. Okay, so now, I haven't even heard right-wing spin about this yet, okay? I just heard NPR mention he'd been in Iran and without any context like you just provided. And so I just assume that the right-wing talking point is, aha, see, Iran, al-Qaeda, and no more details or context than that. That's all you need to know, that those two things are the same and best friends and working against us. And I called Flint Leverett this morning, actually, and he said he didn't know the specifics of this guy's case, but that it was safe to assume that he was under the control of the Iranian government, if not under outright house arrest, under more or less house arrest with the rest of them. And those are the same people you're referring to there that they tried to negotiate with us over to trade for the MEK, et cetera.
Yeah, he was under house arrest, no question about it. And you're right, the right-wing spin on this has been that not that the Iranians arrested this group, but that the Iranians were giving them shelter. That they've been saying that the Iranians have been providing support for Al Qaeda, which of course is ridiculous. It's not even nearly the same thing. They arrested them. They offered to turn them over to the United States if there had been any cooperation at all with the White House, and then they finally let them go, and that's why this guy has resurfaced.
It's just amazing. Sorry for the tangent, but isn't it amazing right-wing propaganda in America? And I don't even mean like the kooky stuff, but I mean the more or less what counts as the center-right media in America, where every single thing they say is wrong or an outright lie. And it's like they're just drowning in propaganda. They never let these people come up for air with a single true fact ever. It's always BS. Always.
Well, that's why people are getting tired of it. I noticed even during the Rand Paul filibuster, for which I give Rand Paul credit. I mean, this is the first thing he's done that, to my mind, is really significant in a positive way. But the thing was, even there, like Marco Rubio was coming out with this comment to the effect of, Holder has not told us that barring an imminent threat, we won't use drones to kill American citizens on American soil. I mean, Christ, this is not even the right question. The right question is, why is anyone contemplating using drones to kill anyone on U.S. soil? And who is the one that sits back and decides what is an imminent threat? We know how that'll play out.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, to be fair to him, geez, that's probably even as wrong as he got it, as sophisticated as Republican thinking is on radio or on Capitol Hill that I can find anywhere, you know? That's like algebra 2. Come on, that's pretty good.
Sure, they think it's probably just fine to zap somebody from a drone as long as you can claim there's some kind of imminent threat. I mean, the guy had a water pistol or something. I mean, it's just like this stuff never ends. They don't seem to realize that if you give just the government just a little crack to get into to twist things around, they're going to do that. That's been the history of of the last 12 years. There's no question about that. And it's about time people wake up to that's what's occurring. I mean, all this stuff is wrong. And none of these Republicans are gonna see it, that's for sure. That's why the Republican Party hopefully will die a death at some point. Maybe we'll bring the Federalists or the Whigs back.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of few great things about that filibuster. I guess one of them is watching the left wing crack up over whether it was horrible or wonderful. But it's going to be fun because it is just the beginning of the second Democratic administration of Barack Obama here. And so with this push, it could mean, at least some comedy as some of these Bush Republicans in, at least maybe in the Senate, whatever, people who are trying to suck up to Rand and continue to watch them pretend to care about civil liberties at all. Like, remember John Ashcroft in the 90s complaining about the Know Your Customer regulations where the banks were let loose on to spy on us all and turn over all of our information? And they complained about Carnivore and some of the warrantless wiretapping stuff going on back then. And that should just be fun to watch, you know, these Republicans like Ted Cruz pretending to be an ACLU guy, you know?
Yeah, and as you say, the other interesting story, of course, is the crack up of the Democrats. I mean, why was it that only two Democratic senators got on the bandwagon on this issue of drones killing people in the United States? Is party solidarity more important than doing what's right? Yeah, obviously it is.
Well, and I think one of them got on the bandwagon. The other one came out there and cried 9/11.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's kind of scary. I mean, like, who do you turn to? There's just nobody. Our system's been so corrupted and by what's happened over the last 10 years that there's not really much hope for changing it. I don't know. I'm doing a piece right now on the AIPAC meeting this week in Washington. And, I'm saying essentially, if we go to war against Iran, that means that AIPAC wins. What is the option for us, for the rest of the people? I mean, we're going to be in deep kimchi in no time if there's a war against Iran. And it's the average people that are going to suffer, people like me and you. And I said, what is the solution here? Do we all have to engage in civil disobedience? Is that the only route that we have left? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, and even then, like, what sort of civil disobedience is going to do it unless we somehow, get every sports and pop star to all lead a giant nationwide march on D.C. or something? Nobody's interested. How are you going to get them to do it, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. And, I mean, it seems to me like Obama, and this is, what do I know, but it seems like Obama wants a sort of status quo thing on Iran, and he wants to basically just leave it, let the next president work out a nuclear deal, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, as the Leverett's pointed out on the show last week, hey, he's waging a region-wide, not-so-covert war against Iran right now, and that can turn into open warfare at any time. Don't sell him short. You know, he's as dangerous as Bush at this point.
Sure, and especially with this Graham Menendez bill, which looks like it's going to fly through the Senate.
Yeah, tell us about
basically,
that.
Well, there's a bill currently sitting in the Senate. I think it's Senate Resolution 96 or something like that. It's basically directed against Iran. It was sponsored by Lindsey Graham and Menendez from New Jersey, and the two of them basically came up with this thing that the wording is something like if Israel is compelled to attack Iran, the United States will provide full financial, diplomatic, and military support. So it's basically a conditional declaration of war, the condition being that Israel can start it. It's one of the scariest things to come out of Congress in a long time, and it doesn't have the authority of law or anything like that. So basically, I guess Obama can ignore it. But the fact is that this kind of rhetoric and this kind of thinking is absolutely amazing, and it's just it puts the whole issue of war and peace in somebody else's hands.
Yeah, it's just amazing that they would even do that. But then again, it's Lindsey Graham, so. I guess, you know, shocking but not surprising, that kind of thing. All right. Well, thanks very much, Phil. It's always great to talk to you.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. That's Phil Giraldi talking turkey about Zionism is the latest piece at antiwar.com. Also see him at the American Conservative Magazine and at the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Tonight on the KPFK show, I don't know yet. KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. See y'all Monday.
The Emergency Committee for Israel. Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site. At fff.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At libertystickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army. Die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at libertystickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. That's libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.